September 1939 was the blackest month in the history of the hotel business. George Cross, the owner of a number of small residential hotels in London, augured the collapse of the entire sector. "I warn the faint-hearted and the powers that be," he declared, "that unless immediate steps are taken, scarcely an hotel will be available to accommodate naval and military officers and others whose business will sooner or later take them to the metropolis." Cross chose to close his establishment in Marble Arch, but others were simply obliged to hand over the keys to the authorities. The War Office claimed the Hotel Victoria and the Metropole on Northumberland Avenue. The Army requisitioned the Great Central at Marylebone. One floor soon became the domain of MI9, the secret department charged with aiding Allied troops trapped behind enemy lines. Across the country, the pattern was repeated. The managing director of the Buxton Palace Hotel protested that his workplace had been invaded by a horde of arrogant officials, ruthlessly marking with a label everything they thought they might possibly need, from beds to the safe in the office. He was particularly galled by the seizure of his entire canteen of cutlery, commandeered by the occupiers for use in their snack bar. "Expensive lobster forks," he raged, "do not seem suitable for cheap sandwiches." Words like ruthlessness and tyranny echo through these complaints. "I ask despairingly," exclaimed one manager, "whether nothing can be done to prevent our homes and businesses being ransacked and destroyed as though we, and not the Nazis, were the enemy." By the end of the first month of the war, 20,000 hotel workers had been dismissed from their posts. And George Reeve Smith, in his capacity as vice chairman of the Hotels and Restaurants Association, issued a public warning about the paralysis of a great industry. It was a paralysis that seemed to presage something more terminal. Slowly, however, the guests and the diners returned. After 11 days of darkness and silence, the Dorchester Ballroom regained its dancers. "Nightlife," reported the diarist of the Daily Express, "is just beginning to glisten faintly again behind our dark doors." The following week, the band struck up again at the Barclay. "After all," said a representative of the hotel, "what is the use of sitting looking at each other during dinner?" By December, the shiny papers were reporting a phenomenon. "Most of the big hotels have discovered and smartened up some previously unconsidered place, lurking somewhere in their depths," reported the Tatler, merged for the sake of the war economy with the Bystander. "Here, their nightlife flourishes, while the grand grills, restaurants and lounges preserve an eerie emptiness. But everyone knows that something pretty purposeful is going on somewhere. Long deserted passages, perhaps a sinister hotel servant directing you along them. Stairs down, sudden bits of naked brick wall and grubby little doors giving onto goodness knows what. Then, suddenly, there is a burst of music, and there everybody is, making merry just as usual in the new quarters where, perhaps, provisions used to be stored." The Savoy restaurant was reincarnated in the form of a subterranean banqueting room reinforced with scaffolding. The Ritz reopened its underground spaces. A notice on the ground floor advertised a seasonable novelty, a snack or full meal in an air raid shelter. As the war approached its second month, Chips Channon, Conservative MP for Southend, informed his diary that the Ritz had become fantastically fashionable, concluding confidently, "Ritzes always thrive in wartime." The following year, he made a similar report from the Dorchester. "London lives well. I've never seen more lavishness, more money spent, or more food consumed than tonight, and the dance floor was packed. There must have been 1,000 people." Before he departed for Belfast, where he was stationed with the Royal Signal Corps, Victor Legg watched the visitors return to the gilded spaces of the Ritz. "We thought the war would kill the place," he recalled. "But once people got comfortable with the blackout and all the restrictions, they came back, and it seemed more lively than it had been for years." Instead of vanishing into history, London's grand hotels became more prominent in the cultural and political life of this country than ever before. They were the homes of cabinet ministers and military leaders, plutocrats and aristocrats. At lunch tables and in smoking rooms, decisions were made that affected the progress of the war. Hotel apartments became the retreats of governments in exile, diplomatic missions, and the deposed monarchies of occupied Europe. Journalists filed articles from makeshift offices carved from the carcasses of once expensive suites. Con artists and swindlers, invigorated by the opportunities brought by war, hunted for victims among the potted palms. Illegal abortionists, profiting from the wartime increase in unwanted pregnancies, conducted their business behind locked hotel room doors. Writers, poets, artists, musicians, and prostitutes haunted bars and lobbies. Below the pavement of Piccadilly, a flourishing homosexual subculture worked its way through the Ritz's stock of gin and Angostura bitters. Cooks tested the limits of the rationing law and their own ingenuity, confecting dishes from acorns and turnips and eels, and cooking on electric radiators when the bombs deprived them of gas. It was their recipes that the nation followed. Spies and spymasters made rooms above Park Lane, Piccadilly, Brook Street and the Strand into thriving centres of espionage, using quiet suites for debriefings and interrogations, picking at the plasterwork for hidden microphones and dispatching agents of the secret state to loiter in the coffee lounges and listen for treachery. The Dorchester, the Savoy, the Ritz and Claridge's. Each was a kind of Casablanca.